Good morning. I don't know about you guys, but watching the news lately has kind of got me a little concerned. I guess I just didn't realize that there were so many things out there where, you know, you could be harmed if you weren't paying attention. A lot of kind of bad stuff going on out there, and you know, just never know how careful you need to be. You know, you don't know who's eating at this table or who sat in that chair before you, so you know, need to take precautions. I found out the other day that from a news report that depending on what TV shows you watch, it could have an impact on your waistline. Researchers have now discovered that entertaining TV shows tend to make you eat more. Because evidently your brain disconnects from your mouth, and your brain doesn't know what your mouth is doing, and so you tend to consume more. So I guess the report was trying to tell me that I needed to only watch boring shows if I'm going to watch television. So now I'm kind of trying to mark all the shows that might be interesting and keep away from those because, you know, I wouldn't want to overeat while I'm watching a TV show. And then I came across another report that said if I take the medication for restless leg syndrome, you know, the kind where you can't keep your legs stopped. If I take that, I need to be careful because it's been known to lead to compulsive gambling. And that's got me concerned now. You know, I'll start playing the lottery all the time or, you know, maybe go to Vegas a lot if I start taking that medication. And then I found out that it's not really very safe to buy a dog on the internet. So if you're going on the internet, you know, you want to pick up a couple cute little Rottweiler puppies or something, and, you know, on the internet, I guess there's some kind of big scam out there for people who buy pets on the internet. And then I heard that you need to be careful about using this hand cleaner around flames. I understand people have been known to go up in flames by using this hand sanitizer. And you know, with all of the things out there to worry about, you know, I start thinking as a parent, I mean, if I want to be a good parent to protect my kids from all of the stuff out there, there's just a lot to keep up with. And so, you know, I was wrestling with this. I decided, you know, maybe I need to make a list. And so I started working on a list of the things that, you know, as a good parent, if I want to be a good parent to my kids, you know, what are some of the things I just need to pay attention to and keep up with? And, you know, there's just a lot of health issues. And, you know, so child-proofing everything is very important. I make sure that everything's protected. I read the labels on everything. I got to get one of those little plastic guys with the flag to put out in the street in front of my house. So if my kids go out in the yard, the traffic will slow down. That's pretty important. And then I started worrying about some of the harder things, like what if my kids are not accepted by their peer group? And so, you know, I need to purchase certain clothes so they'll fit in. I need to make sure that, you know, that they are well adjusted so that they can talk right in a group. You know, make sure that they have the right iPods and iPhones and automobiles so, you know, that they'll feel good, because if they're not accepted by their peers, that could create a lot of anxiety. And then I started thinking about, you know, what if they don't enjoy their siblings? You know, like what if my kids don't really enjoy each other? And so now I realize I've got to start intervening in all their conflicts, because, you know, I need to make sure that if they start kind of getting on each other, that doesn't get out of hand. Because if that got out of hand, I mean, no telling, maybe they wouldn't talk to each other or they wouldn't come back to the family reunion when they leave. And so I was worried about that. And then I started worrying about what if they say something stupid or inappropriate, or somebody calls them a name when they're out socializing in their peer groups. I mean, that could really bruise their ego. They may be damaged for life, and I'm really worried about that. How do I train kids to always talk appropriately so that they don't embarrass themselves? Because, you know, those most embarrassing moments, they tend to last a lifetime. You know, even now, people ask questions like, what's your most embarrassing moment? And, you know, that would be really tragic. And then I came up with this other one. What if my kids don't get picked for select sports? And What if they don't make the honor roll? Because if they don't make the honor roll, then they won't get into a good college. And if they don't get into a good college, they won't get a good job. And if they don't get a good job, then they're going to end up living with me indefinitely. And that retirement dream goes out the window, and I'm really worried about that. So they've got to get a good job. What if they don't like me? You know, I'm really worried about that because, you know, I feel like that if I discipline my kids, then they're not going to like me, and that would really hurt my ego and bruise me. But, you know, if I don't discipline my kids, they're going to turn out to be brats, and then nobody else will like me. And so I'm kind of in a dilemma because, you know, if I want them to really like me, then everybody else may not like me because everywhere I go, my kids are acting like brats, and man, these are tough things. And that's not to mention things like, you know, there's evil in the world, terrorism, disease. We got this global warming problem. Social Security is going to fail. So who's going to support me when I'm old? They're not. Drafted into war. I mean, who knows? And then I start thinking, you know, as a Christian, now I can double my list. Because not only are there all the other things that everybody else worries about, but as a Christian, then I've got a whole additional list of things to worry about. So I started writing these down. What if they reject God? What if they have sex before marriage? That would be a problem. What if they choose an alternative lifestyle? What if they marry an unbeliever? What if they choose a worldly lifestyle? You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. What am I going to do then? You know, if I make them go to church, that could be a problem because then later on they may say that they, you know, really hated the fact that they had to go to church and be bored or be in the youth group and be bored, so I don't want them to do that, so I don't want to make them go to church. But if I don't make them go to church, then they won't know God. And they won't connect with God anyway, so they're going to... This is tough. And you know what? What is a loving, concerned parent supposed to do in a world filled with fear, when every single news report has some other thing to worry about, every product has multiple warning labels, everyone is telling you that to be a good parent, you got to pave the way for your kids. We're beginning to develop in our society a phenomenon called paranoia. Paranoia. You say, what is paranoia? Well, paranoia is what leads us to shielding our kids from normal life. It leads to shielding our kids from normal life. What paranoia does is we try to step in and ensure that our kids are not bored, they don't experience any pain, they don't ever get embarrassed, they don't ever fail, they don't ever struggle in a relationship, they don't ever have a conflict with authority, they don't ever feel lonely, they don't ever feel sad, because if we have it within our power to somehow pave the way for our kids to have a pain-free life, then we have got to be the best parents in the world, because isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that what it's all about? Here's the problem with paranoia. Paranoia leads us to move away from faith into fear. Away from allowing a child to grow as they experience normal life and into a control or live the pain for the kids. So we talked about in our first message, the helicopter parent that's constantly there, fixing, solving problems, or the 911 parent who rescues. Every time something goes wrong, there's a rescue plan in place. Or the drill sergeant parent that's never going to let anything be hard because they're going to control it from day one. Everything is regimented. To the Barney parent who's just going to try to cover up life with a blast. You know, life is purple. And so let's just have fun. And in the middle of all that, our kids are finding themselves moving into adulthood with higher depression rates, higher anxiety rates, higher frustration rates than ever before. So, what are some of the things that grow out of that? I would say that there are two false views that come out of that. The first false view is a false view of life. And here's the life that comes, the view of life that comes from paranoia. The false view is that normal life means painless life. Normal means painless. If I grow up in a world where all my problems are being fixed for me, then I begin to think that normal means that life just rocks along and everything ought to be good. And if something goes wrong, well, that's not normal. And so I resent the problems, I resent the challenges, I resent the frustrations, because this is not the way it's supposed to be. Life is supposed to be good all the time. I got that from my mom and dad. They did their best and worked their hardest to try to make it that way for me. The second false view that arises from this is a false view of God. A false view of God, and that view is this, that if life hurts, God is somehow failing me. If life hurts, then God is somehow failing me. Now, we know that children, from the earliest age, frequently will get their emotional understanding of who God is or what God feels like from mom or dad or both. Children often identify the God of the universe with what they experience from the authority figures or the control figures or the parental nurturing figures in their life. So what happens if they perceive that the nurturing figures in their life have taken on the task of making life really pain-free? I mean, if I've got an ouch, I get a Barney Band-Aid and an aspirin. And if the ouch continues more than a day, I get a trip to the doctor and, you know, I'm going to get some of the pink medicine or some of the white medicine. And, you know, if it's worse than that, then we're going to go to the hospital. Because my mom and dad, their goal is to make it pain-free. If I have a conflict with a person in authority, a coach or a teacher, mom and dad, they're going to go to that person and they're going to straighten that person out. Because my life is supposed to be easy. If I don't sign up in time for the team, mom and dad are going to go and they're going to work the system if they have to get me into that activity, because life is about them paving the way. And so I become an adult and I don't get the job that I really, really went to 4 years of college to get. And I'm looking now to my parental figure, my father in heaven. And what do I think? I think, God, there's something wrong here, because your job is to intervene in my life in such a way that it's smooth, that it's normal, that it's pain-free. That kind of parenting approach places a child in risk of really developing the wrong perspective on life. Let's take the hourglass here. One of our pastors mentioned this to me. I think it's a great illustration of what real parenting is supposed to look like. Let's take this sand and let's call it life experience. That is, experience where I faced a challenge in life, I trusted God, I saw His power, and I worked through it, and now I have grounding. In other words, I have a conflict with another sibling or another child, and I think the end of the world has just come, and I'm really upset and I'm really angry. But you know what? I work through that. And I pray and I ask God to give me wisdom, and I maybe eat some humble pie, and I change my tone, and we talk it out and we work it out. And then you know what? I come to the other side of that, and now I have got a life experience where I have some confidence that when things go south in a meeting, when someone criticizes me, or when I have a tough relationship, I've got some ballast, some sand to say, I can get through this with God's help. Now, as an adult, we've got a whole bunch of experiences that we've been given, and as we weather those experiences, it prepares us for adult life. The role of parent is to ensure that our children leave home having that same kind of ballast, experiences, knowing how to fail, knowing how to lose, knowing how to deal with embarrassment, knowing how to wrestle with authority figures that don't always see eye to eye with you, knowing how to be disappointed, and knowing how to trust God for the pain and the challenges of life. Now, the part of parenting that is really an art is recognizing that this little neck in the hourglass is where we come in. it's our job to recognize the age of our children and the challenge that's out there and try to help manage the flow of life experiences. In other words, you don't go out and try to create life experiences to teach your child. You know, get a hammer, smash your kid on the hand, say, "Oh, it hurts, doesn't it? Well, that's what life's like. Get used to it." But that's not what we're talking about. As gravity pulls the sand down, the gravity represents the providence of God, where God is going to bring things into your child's life along the way. And along the way, as God brings things into your child's life, then you work with them, you pray with them, you coach them, but you don't take over and remove their growth and remove God's power from the equation. The goal is that by the time they leave home, they've got the ballast of experience to understand the reality of life so that they can then turn that over and pass it on to the next generation. In James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, James says this. He says, "Consider it all joy whenever you face various trials." Now, why would you consider it joy when you face trials? James goes on to say, because the testing of your faith produces endurance or patience, perseverance. And let perseverance have its perfect work in you, because it will make you complete, it will make you mature, lacking in nothing. In other words, James is telling us that the problems of our life, when viewed through the eyes of faith, when met with the hand of God, they actually make us mature. They grow us to have confidence in God. And that's the goal that we're after in parenting. Now travel with me on a journey in time and in space to a valley. It's the Valley of Elah. And running down through the valley is a creek. And as you look into this valley and you see the grass that's growing in the valley, you see the wildflowers, you see the dragonflies and the butterflies that are landing and floating around in this valley, it initially looks like a very serene place. And as you journey in closer, the tight shot, you begin to notice that there's a young man who's kneeling by the creek. And you see him first, you think, you know, he looks like a young man. No, he's still a teenager. Oh no, maybe he's a young man. It's hard to tell. But as you look, it appears that he's just kneeling in the middle of this field by this creek as the babbling creek runs along, and he's doing something down there. Maybe he's praying. No, he's not praying. He's gathering stones. He's picking up stones and he's feeling them to find ones that are smooth, that are aerodynamic. And one by one, he puts 5 stones into his bag. Now, as our camera angle pans back and we get a bigger view of what's taking place there, it looks anything but serene. For what you begin to notice is that lining the ridge on one side of the valley and lining the ridge on the other side of the valley is a whole group of soldiers, men at war. These are men who are standing there in their makeshift armor, swords, shields, and they're looking at this boy, this young man, kneeling in the middle of this valley. These are hardened men. These are adult men. These are grown men that know what it means to fight. And on the one side, you see the armies of Philistia. The Philistines are lined up in their battle array. On the other side, you see the nation of Israel, the armies of Israel lined up. And then immediately your attention is drawn to someone who has stepped out from the battle lines and is standing in the valley looking across at the boy. It's the biggest guy you've ever seen. If you watch wrestling, he's bigger than any of those guys, bigger than the great Kali, my son tells me. Nobody's heard of Kali, huh? See, Sam? Nobody watches that but you. It's the biggest guy you've ever seen. In fact, this guy is so big that in order to put a shield in front of him that is meaningful, he has a guy that's his full-time job, is just to carry the shield into battle and set it up in front of him. The guy is about 9 feet tall, and he is a hardened warrior. And he's standing in the battleground. On the other side, you see another man who's bigger than everybody else standing in front. And he's got a worried look on his face. This man is King Saul. King Saul is bigger than all the other soldiers. And these two soldiers, these two giants, so to speak, are standing in the battle. And there in the middle is this young boy. No armor. Doesn't look like he's ever fought a fist fight in his life, much less fought in this kind of battle. And he's kneeling in the middle of that scene. Now, how do you get into that kind of place where the whole world is watching as one boy walks out into the middle of this scene? Let me take you to the passage of Scripture. It's found in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And I would encourage you, if you have your Bibles, to open up to 1 Samuel chapter 17. As you're turning there, let me just say that what this young man is facing is a giant. And what we desire as parents would be to release our kids into the world with the kind of confidence and courage that they could face the big giant issues of life, the giant problems in life, with an unflinching courage and an unwavering faith in God. A life that's not built around fear, but built in the confidence of faith. And in order to raise a giant killer, we've got to give our kids three things. The first thing is we've got to give our child reality. We've got to give our child a heavy dose of reality. Look at the scene here. If you'll jump to verse 32, what we have taking place here in this scene is that Goliath, the almost 9 foot tall guy that's the hardened battle kind of freakoid person that nobody knows how this guy got so big, but he's obviously kind of the weird Andre the Giant type guy that once in a lifetime appears, and he's their champion. And he walks down into the middle of the field, and he begins to yell and shout at the army of Israel. And here's what he says. He says, "You guys, we don't need to spill everybody's blood here today. Let's just have a duel. I'll come out, and you guys send out your biggest, strongest, best fighting man, and we'll duke it out right here in the middle of the field. And whoever sheds blood wins. So if I kill your guy, then you guys lay down your swords and your weapons, and you'll be our servants. And if you kill me, if your guy kills me, then we'll just surrender to you, and we'll get it over with that way." And then he begins to curse their God and call them a bunch of cowards. Well, David, who's been taking care of his dad's flock, David is bringing supplies to his three brothers who are there on the battle lines, and he sees this unfold, and he hears this giant shouting out these words, and so he says, "What's everybody afraid of? I'll fight the guy. Let me do it." Word gets to King Saul, and here's where we pick up verse 32. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy, and he has been a fighting man from his youth." Now, we've got to get some perspective on this. So let me just see. I want the biggest person in the room, okay? Anybody in here 7 feet tall or taller? Just stand up. No? 6'11". Anybody 6'11 or taller? 6'10". Come on, there's got to be somebody 6'10". Bunch of shrimps. Okay, 6'9". Last hour I had three guys that were 6'9". Where? Oh, come on down here. We got to have at least one little guy in the room. You've always wondered where this height would come in handy, haven't you? Come on down here. While you're coming down here, I want my son Sam to come on up here. Sam, come on up here. Come on over here. Okay, tell me your name.
I'm Brian.
Brian, I'm Tim. Thanks for coming up here. You've always wanted to do this, haven't you? The guy first hour, his name was David. Okay, now, here, just to get a feel for what we're talking about. Saul, according to Scripture, stood head and shoulders above all the other men. So, height and body size. This is David. This is Saul. Now, can you imagine any kind of contest between the two of us? We've never had one before, have we, Sam? Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, now, in contrast, you're 6'9"?
Yes.
Okay, now, if you were about a foot, maybe a little over a foot and a half taller, that would be about the size of Goliath. So you can see why Saul is thinking to himself, I'm not going to go out there with this guy. Enter David. I mean, we can tell immediately that this is not going to be a conventional battle. Your sword would be as big as him. About right there. Well, thank you guys very much for coming down here. I wanted to illustrate that. Thank you, Brian, Sam. Okay, now what in the world inspires a young person to have the kind of courage and confidence that something and somebody that big is beatable? And if you're thinking this message is just for teenagers, think about yourself too. When was the last time you faced a giant and trusted God? Well, David had a few things going for him. First thing he had going for him was a healthy dose of reality. Look at what he says. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. Well, wait a minute. David's had a job. He's been working. Not only has David been working, David has been working in the boring family business. He's had a healthy dose of reality since he was very young. His father said, I need someone to take care of the sheep. I got my older boys. They're fighting in the army. They've got responsibilities. I send them off. David, it's your turn. You go and you live with these sheep and take care of them. Now, the shepherd would take these sheep throughout whatever area of grazing they needed to go. So sometimes the shepherd would be days away from the family. And what's David learning? David's learning that life is monotonous. That life is boring. Do our kids ever learn that? Now, how many of you work a full-time job that doesn't have any monotony to it? I mean, most of us, we get up on Monday morning and we kind of do a similar thing to what we did last Monday morning, right? And that's kind of life. Even if you work in the circus, which some of you may be thinking, yeah, that's my place of business, the circus. You still have to clean out the elephant stalls every single day. So where does a child learn to live with boredom? That life is monotonous. That reality is that life is a series of dealing with the issues of routineness and dealing with them well. When I was a child growing up, a phrase I heard over and over and over again from my parents that I don't ever even hear in our generation anymore, but I heard it over and over again. Some of you may have heard it over and over again too. That was the phrase, Tim, you need to make the best of it. See, my grandfather, farmer, would pull up 7 o'clock in the morning during the summer, knock on the door, say, okay, get the boys up. They're going to go work in the field. And we go, oh, it's a summer break. We're kids. We ought to be able to have fun. Well, Tim, you and Steve just need to make the best of it. Because that's reality. That's life. While David is out there in the field, no Nintendo, no IM, what's he doing? He's learning how to write poetry. And he becomes the greatest hymn writer, songwriter, psalmist ever. David's learning how to talk to God. David is learning how to practice with his sling, which is going to come in handy. David has a healthy dose of reality. Son, we need you. Here's your job. Let's get you out there. You need to be part of this thing. This is the world. This is the real world. Our kids, are they shielded from the real world? Second, give a child responsibility. Raising a giant killer, you got to give him responsibility. Look at what David says in verse 34. But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried a sheep from the flock, I went after it. I struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear." Now notice the cause and effect. He says, "This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." David is not saying, "I can go defeat this guy because I am just a great warrior." What David is saying here is, "I've been in a similar situation before, and God brought me through it. I faced the responsibility before of having something that was entrusted to me, and I was responsible for taking care of it, and I stepped up to that responsibility. It was scary, it was hard, it required courage, and you know what? God was with me. In fact, it was a situation where without God's help, what am I going to do? I can't do this without God's help." So David is not talking about his confidence based on his fighting ability, his athleticism, his ability to throw a stone. What David is talking about is his confidence based on his experience with God and seeing God come through for him in the past. Now that is a powerful tool in the hand of a growing individual. A young person that experiences the hardships of life and faces them with courage, believing that God helped them, will make all the difference in the world when they go into adulthood to face the giants of life. You know, I think about it, I'm sure that David's mom and dad prayed for him every night while he was out taking care of the sheep. You know, "God, keep the lion away. Keep the bear away." It's just like you and I would pray. You know, every night while my kids were away on mission trips this past week, my wife and I prayed, "God, keep them safe. God, keep them safe. Protect them." You know what? God did not answer David's parents' prayer for his safety. He let the bear come. He let the lion come. God wanted to answer a greater prayer. And the greater prayer was, "Teach my son how he can trust you in the midst of the struggles of life." And David learned responsibility, and so he speaks not as a teenager, but as a man of confidence and courage. And Saul picks up on it. In fact, Saul hears it. I love this next statement. He says, after he gets done speaking, Saul said to David, "Go. Go fight him, and the Lord be with you." Now, as he goes out to fight, Saul tries to dress him in armor, and David says, "I can't wear your armor." Verse 41, meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. Now, the scene is David's at the brook. He's picking up the stones. Here comes the Philistine. He starts moving across the field toward this one individual who's had the guts to walk out there, this kid, and it doesn't make him very happy. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." Now David stands up and he begins to talk back to this big guy. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into your hands." You see who David's confidence is? David's confidence is completely and totally in God. This is not about a clash of abilities. This is not about my AP exams. This is not about my batting average. This is not about my good looks. This is not about my social prowess. This is not about my mom and dad's money. this is about God. And I've had experience with God that props me up to be able to face this responsibility. My favorite part is this next part. As the Philistine moved closer to David, David ran. Which is what everybody might have expected. As he gets a little closer, this kid's going to think, what in the world was I thinking? I'm out of here. Oh, wrong direction. It says David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. He's not timid. He's moving. He ran to meet him, reaching into his bag, taking out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead, and the stone sank into the forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Now, the army of Israel is looking at this big guy, and they're all thinking, this guy is way too big to hit. And David is thinking, this guy is way too big to miss. Like, how could anybody miss a guy this big? Now think of the moment. Like, there's dead silence. All of these grown men on the Philistine side, all of these grown men on the Israelite side, and they're holding their breath. They're thinking, what in the world is going to happen? This guy, he doesn't even have a sword. He's got this little shepherd sling. He's slinging it around like this. Our guy's coming in there, and he's going to just massacre, and this is just going to be the goriest thing that ever happened. And all of a sudden, as David's running toward him, he releases that stone, and when he releases that stone, you see the big man begin to stagger. And down he goes. You could have heard a pin drop. And David, he's in full stride, runs up to him, and he starts pulling his sword out. I wonder what the armor bearer was doing. Pulls this big old sword out and finishes the job. And all of a sudden, you hear a war cry from the armies of Israel has never been heard before as they begin to charge down across that valley. And you don't hear anything but the dropping and the clanking of sword and shield as the Philistines begin to run away on the other side. Hey, if a kid can kill our best, we're in a world of hurt. And in the midst of all of that, Saul, who as the king should have been out there fighting, says this, verse 55, as Saul watched David going out to meet the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is that young man? Whose son is that young man? Isn't that powerful? Like, Abner knows there's something about the old man that allowed this kid to face reality, to learn responsibility. And then the final principle here that we've got to get is we've got to give a child a parent who trusts God. A parent who trusts God. He says, who is the son is this young man? And Abner replied, as surely as you live, O king, I don't know. David's dad is just an average guy. Nobody even knows who he is. He's not a big name person. He's not a celebrity. He's just a normal person. Which goes to show you that normal people who trust God can instill within their kids a supernatural confidence that gives them the courage to race in to kill the giants in their lives. It doesn't take someone with a seminary degree. It doesn't take someone that's got all kinds of money or has a gregarious, outgoing personality. What it takes is a parent who has confidence in God and lives that out by letting their child experience reality, by letting their child face responsibility, by letting their child learn to trust God. And so when she's sitting in her room and her heart's broken because that stupid 16-year-old boy who doesn't have a lick of sense, he's 16, broke up with her for the cheerleader. Maybe all you need to do is just go in and cry for a few minutes and say, honey, let's just pray. Let's just trust God because God's got something different. I can't shield you from the pain. I can't fix this. I'm not going to take you shopping to get your mind off of it. Let's just forget about this. Let's go have fun, Barney. Or when your son has to go pay that traffic ticket. Oh, no, no, let me take care of that for you. No. Let's talk about it. Let's pray about it. Because these are the experiences that will lead you to the confidence in God that will allow you to conquer the giants that you will face in the future. It doesn't take somebody well known to raise a giant killer. All it takes is someone who has more faith than fear, more confidence in God than in their own ability to control the circumstances of their children's lives to make it all work out. Which one of those are you? Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, we just recognize that at the end of the day, when all is said and done, what we really need is you. We really need to know you. We really need to trust you. We really need to love you. And we need to allow you to be God, not only in our lives, but in the lives of our kids. Father, we need you. Lord Jesus, we need you.